Rage with John Bowd on www.traxfm.org.
Hello, listeners. Oh, that's a very radio voice. Dave will be pleased with that. Welcome to All the Rage. And once again, I'm here with a guest. I'm here with a full-time OG gold coin-owning guest because he's been with us so many times in the great fight against...
Too kind.
I do what I can. It is, of course, a writer, trade unionist, and most importantly, podcaster, when we have the time. It is Jamie Woodcock. What's happening, mate?
Yeah, it's always a pleasure to come and join you on the show, John. Yeah, lots to talk about today, I guess.
There is. We won't actually talk about upcoming episodes of our podcast as of yet, because, of course, I'm concentrating on the day job here. I'm not just going to advertise my side hustle, Marks at Play and Working Class Cinema, which you can find at all good distributors of podcasts. Anyway, what's happening with your latest union battle? Let's have a little catch up on that one.
So this is, you know, it's one of these things that you predict is likely to happen, and then it starts happening and you think, well, there's not really anyone to say I told you so, but it's what's happening in higher education. And I guess there are two things really to kind of give some context about it. The first is higher education in Britain has gone through a number of changes over the past few decades. And one of the most significant changes is that, you know, I spend most of my job, as most of my colleagues do, teaching international students who pay loads of money to come and study in Britain. And there have been some changes over the last year where the current government policy is to try and reduce immigration, as probably people have seen in the news. And they've made it much, much harder for international students to come and study in Britain. And so there's been a huge drop in international student numbers this year. And given universities are based on, at the moment, bringing international students in to pay a load of money to study masters, all across the sector, universities are going into crisis. So I think at the last count, it's something like 40 universities doing restructurings, announcing redundancies. And in a way, this is also the kind of part of the plan of the Tory government to change higher education from the way it's currently organised to being much more focused on, you know, providing skills, not giving students the chance to come and study whatever they want or have a bit of time out of working to kind of read books and think about ideas, but like a university system that's much more focused on training people for the workplace.
Quick flashback to those, if people don't remember those adverts of a ballet dancer or somebody else, and just basically said this person's next job could be in writing code or something. Do you remember those? Something to that effect. Yeah. So it's pretty clear they've had that sort of attitude of like, your arty ideas are all fine and dandy, but this isn't what we want you to do. So shut up and code.
Yeah, and I think also there's a kind of classic hatred of the Conservative Party for the idea that like jumped up working class kids might want to go and study, you know, and exactly. that kind of studying is just for like, you know, the elite who are going to go on to be the next elite. And actually, you know, working class kids should go and do an apprenticeship. They should go and get straight into work, like not get ideas above their station, right?
We need them to bolster the country and keep it going, even when we're not even sure which direction it's going in. You know, it's basically the message I get from it. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think also this sort of fear that like universities are like a bastion of the left and it's like lefty professors not teaching useful money-making skills, but instead teaching people critical theory and telling them that British values are actually not that good. And, you know, as a place of kind of, yeah, where they're not getting the Tory ideas pushed, right? Some of it's, you know, some of it's related to that as well, I think.
So this is the culture war in a sort of, this is one of the ways and it can actually lead to affecting people's real lives. You know, all these kind of imagined notions of knocking supposed British values, which is nothing new, actually, certainly, because we've been ripping that bullshit apart since I was a kid, among other things. So, and I'm sure people have been doing it for a lot longer than I've been around.
You know, also to like take a step back from the university stuff is like, it's not like university is the only place where people can attack those ideas or can learn things or can, you know, read or come across other ideas. But it has played a bit of that role in Britain, right? You know, particularly with the push to get half of young people going to university, you know, that has been a place where some of that can happen, right?
Yeah. And I mean, one of the other things that strikes me as you were just describing that then was, I don't know, you know, as an unreformed old lefty that I am, I do love a 5-year plan, but I'm just thinking about kind of wider planning here. So I don't think the next government is going to be any different, really, in so many ways. But is there sort of no thought along these lines of, well, actually, some of these restrictions might be lifted. The classic Blair era, for want of, you know, for better or worse, was around the whole sort of idea of let's send 50% of the population to university. So are they not going to, all these redundancies that are being made at universities, they're not going to suddenly turn around and just go, oh, shit, we haven't got enough lecturers. Oh, they're actually just the restrictions, so we're getting loads more foreign students coming in. What are we going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a funny one, right? Like, at the moment, I don't think there is much of a plan from the current government because they're not going to be the current government for much longer, right?
Exactly.
And yeah, so I think there's like a level of chaos that, you know, they're trying to do things. And I think, you know, I don't know why I did this, but the other day I watched PMQs on BBC News while I was eating my lunch. And like the tone of the debate and the kind of, you know, the dog whistling to far right politics, the discussions around immigration, you get a real sense that the current government is just grasping at whatever it can. And I think, you know, partly reducing the number of students coming to Britain from overseas is a way of making it look like they're being hard on immigration, right? But it's a short-term thing because these are migrants who are coming to Britain to spend a load of money, cross-subsidizing higher education. You know, this is a self-defeating thing to do, really. But it ties in with that kind of broader, like, horrible anti-immigrant rhetoric that's being pushed at the moment, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's never not pushed. And I suppose I'll come back. Well, no, I suppose I'll say this now. To give an example of this just in my lifetime, the first time I heard a political representative say the terms want my country back, or the British people want their country back, it was the fella Derek something, can't remember his name, who I believe it was 1993, and the BNP got somebody elected into Tower Hamlets, I think it was. And now I've just heard a conservative politician, I mean, a man who's nowhere near as prominent or popular as the media would like you to believe he is, or he'd like you to believe he is, I think is fairly irrelevant. But nevertheless, just very openly say it as he's defecting from the very, very right-wing Conservative Party to the slightly further right Reform. That's an idea of how kind of mainstream that language has become. I mean, at the risk of spinning off on one here, but, you know, it's always good when we have these conversations, so let's give it a go. I kind of see this as part of the... A country runs in one direction or another, right? Based on what, and you might agree with it and you might not, and you might see some benefits to it. And, you know, I've lived since the 80s and I've seen things that had some kind of short-term benefit. They made the economy bubble a little bit. Obviously, it was never evenly distributed. We know that. That wasn't Margaret Thatcher's ideology. She didn't believe in it. So, you know, that never happened, and there was all the problems now. And today, I think we're dealing with the massive after-effects of that era. But it also seems like that not only is the country sliding downward in regards, you know, an economy that doesn't actually do anything outside of hiding very rich people's money, and doesn't even provide many services anymore. Do you think there's an element, this is a bit philosophical, so bear with me. Do you think there's an element of like national self-hatred in what we're doing to the country now? Not just to Johnny Foreigner and you know, the working class British, as we've just pointed out, but just overall, there's like a sort of nihilistic self-destruction drive that's running through British culture right now.
So I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think in part, there is within the Conservative Party, like, no evidence left of the kind of one nation Toryism or a kind of sense that there is a bigger project behind what they're trying to do. And I think this is one of the things that makes it quite different to Thatcherism. That Thatcherism was a political project, right? And it was about a transformation of British society. I mean, obviously not one that we agree with, but there was a plan, there were strategies, there were things that they were trying to do. Whereas what comes across with a lot of the current policies is these are like either about personal enrichment. I mean, the COVID stuff is wild, right? Like handing contracts to people's mates, but also a sense of like, you know, they are not going to win the next election. What can they do to benefit themselves and, you know, their class essentially in between now and then? And a lot of that is whipping up the far right, you know, pushing the Lettuce MP, whose name I keep forgetting, who was almost outlasted by that Lettuce on the news. She went on a podcast with Steve Bannon, who was praising Tommy Robinson, saying that she had her election stolen by the left, and she's like nodding along with it. There are, you know, there's a kind of self-destructiveness to the Tories at the moment, I think, which is also about the failure of them to generate a leadership within the Conservative Party, right? They're just churning through different leaders at the moment. So yeah, there's a kind of like apocalyptic streak to it, right?
Yeah, no, you're right. And it's like, what can I get on the way out the door? And it is, yeah. It really is something to... And look, let's be very, very clear here, right? I do not have any kind of great respect for the political system in this country or the office of Prime Minister, okay? They've all been scumbags to a greater or lesser degree in my lifetime, and I'm sure there's a good few of them before then. The idea they might have dressed nicely or spoken more politely is completely irrelevant. But to go from being a Prime Minister of Britain, as Liz Truss just did, to appearing, like you say, on basically a program that's almost like a podcast, something like some of this basically got even less credibility than what we're talking on right now, is really something. I mean, if we saw any other part of the world do this, we would, that our media would be full of people sneering at it and talking about, you know, if Maduro went on some TV program, a TV show or podcast, some bargain basement, you know, with some ranting dipshit like Steve Bannon, the media in this country would just be like, oh, the state of Venezuela, look at this, this is what their leaders do. While their people are starving, the leader goes on, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, it's kind of nuts. And it really is a question of like, yeah, you know, you're going to be out the door soon, so you're just grabbing everything you can from the public purse, lest we remind people. What can we get? What juicy bits of public finance can we snatch from a country that's, I can honestly see being, you know, bankrupting itself within the next 10 years or less. Dear God, I hope I'm wrong about that. I really, really want to be wrong about that. Wild prediction, which I'm hoping is completely wrong. But yeah, basically, it can get a hell of a lot worse. It can always get worse. I think you're right. I think that's a really important analysis. And I think that, you know, putting our, should we say, hardcore lefty hats on, putting, if you like, our, well, I think this is a Marxist hat, but you've studied it more than I have, so you can tell me if I'm wrong. I feel like this is kind of the end of a complete obsession with endless growth, which is simply unachievable, and endless accumulation for the individual, and absolutely no moral stance, no moral barrier, or any other barrier for that matter, on any of that kind of behavior, to the point where you can just get, you know, just accumulate. There is no such thing as consequence. You know, I haven't thought this out very well, but just, I'm just randomly popping this off, you know. So what's what it kind of feels like to me?
I think it makes a lot of sense. And I think, you know, the university sector is kind of a good example of this, right? That like the university where I work, we have entered into a financial crisis because we haven't got the numbers of international students that the university predicts we're going to get. Now, this doesn't actually mean we're in a financial crisis because the university still has money, right? Because it brings in all this money from international students. But there's this constant premise of growth. It's not enough to have enough money to pay everyone's salaries and pay for the buildings and, you know, all the things that universities need. You have to be like doing better than the university up the road. Like you could be getting their students, like, you know, year on year, we want growth, which doesn't really make sense because, I mean, A, you know, you can't just keep expanding as a university, right? That's like not the point of a university. We have a whole load in Britain. We have 150 universities. Like we don't want universities to go under as others take all their students. And so I think there's this kind of, it's like a managerial logic, right? That like, it's not good enough just to be operating in the way that you should. Like there's more kind of revenue that can be being made or expansion that can happen. And I mean, one of the things I really wanted to say about what's happening in higher education is like, I think we're going to see a couple of universities close this year. And I think these will be the new, so some of the newer universities, the what we call post-92s in the sector. So the ones that became universities in 1992. A regional one, so a university that is in a smaller city or a big town where the university staff, many of them live, spend money in that community, where students come in, they rent houses, they, not to stereotype students, but they go drinking and they buy takeaway and they buy food and so on. Imagine what the closure of a university does to somewhere like that. It'll be like deindustrialization, but in kind of like deservices, and it will happen very rapidly and like hollow out a community, right? Which, yeah, you know, playing around with migration figures, it's because none of those Tory MPs care about, you know, smaller towns and cities in the Midlands or in the Northeast. They don't care that the kind of implication that the closure of a university could have on somewhere like that.
And if they're willing to shut down a coal mine and an entire industry, they're not going to care less about university. And again, that's a really interesting point you made there, because what strikes me there is that model is taking away the actual main point of an educational institution, which is how can we better educate people? How can we maintain a correct level of education for our students, make their experiences better, maybe even, you know, improve it rather than just maintain it? But no, like you say, it's like, how do we do better than the one at the end of the street? That's not something for education, in my opinion. That's not where we need to be. I wonder who legitimately's viewpoint is that that's actually what they should do. You know, universities should just be some kind of money-making scheme that's got nothing to do with the actual content of what it is that you would actually attend such an institution for in the first place.
Yeah, indeed, right? And those bigger questions are like risk getting lost in all of this, right? But I also think, you know, it's not just us in higher education that's facing this. You know, there's a number of sectors where there's sort of like, it's loggerheads with the national government about the sorts of things that need to change nationally for us to get better places to work, to study, to receive healthcare. Is, you know, you can't win these fights at one university, right? It's about, do we value funding higher education, healthcare, having a postal service? Like, yeah, it's these sort of like struggles that can happen locally, but for us to be able to win them, they like raise much bigger questions about like what we're doing nationally, like what we spend money on, what we choose not to spend money on. So I don't know. I think it's going to be quite a bitter fight in higher education, but it's also, you know, I think has this chance to be a, like another national dispute about, yeah, the choices that are being made, right?
So on that, from a trade union perspective, and I know that higher education can always be difficult as far as reaching out to other people. There's often been a kind of division, which I think actually you described quite well earlier on, in regards to the world of work and the world of education. Not necessarily a division that is real, certainly. I think it's, or certainly one that's of something we should discard now. It's of a different era. What's, if there is any, what's the plan going forward? What are we looking at here to change this and to alert people to what's happening to the British education system? And, you know, obviously fight for your rights as an employee too.
Yeah, I mean, a plan would be really good, wouldn't it? yeah, and without wanting to get too much into it, because it's both like quite a depressing and also like in many ways like quite a boring story of a union. I mean, the National Union for people in academic or academic-related work in higher education is UCU. UCU has just gone through a leadership contest in which the incumbent won. And the debate on the leadership election was not really about what kind of union do we need, what kind of strategies do we need. You know, it wasn't really part of what people were voting on. And, you know, we had a low turnout, the incumbent was re-elected, and the National Union is basically silent at the moment. And so across the, you know, across Britain, local branches are having to figure out like, what do you do when you know, at Goldsmiths, they've announced redundancies that are like a third of the staff. Wow. You know, huge, huge attack on, yeah, on the university. And there's, you know, the National Union, you know, isn't building a campaign to link these things up, to take on a challenge, you know, more widely. And so, you know, it's falling on rank and file members to think through what these things involve. You know, I've been on lots of calls recently with people at different universities, kind of swapping notes and sharing stories and trying to figure out what to do together. But, you know, this story of like bad National Union leadership isn't exactly new, right?
No, it comes up quite a bit. So, okay. I was hoping that was going to be a longer answer, but sadly not. So what else is happening on, well, let's stay in the realms of trade unionism then, if we're done with, unless you want to add anything else on further education, or feel free to come back to it.
I guess, you know, we're in an early phase, but at Goldsmiths, they're on track to be on strike over this, I'm sure. Where I work at Essex, I don't imagine a strike ballot is too far away. I feel like I haven't been on strike this academic year, and that feels quite weird because I've been on strike every year for the last decade. And lo and behold, we're all going to be out on strike again. So I think picket lines at universities will be coming again soon, I think, is probably the short answer.
We like to keep our traditions here in Britain. So, you know. So what's going on in other trade union stuff? So, of course, you're involved with Organised Now, aren't you? Which you and I have had a chin wag or two about off air, but we haven't really talked about it here. So I don't know if you want to say a few things about what that's about.
Yeah. I mean, this is a project I'm always really keen to talk about because it feels like an exciting union project. So it's a initiative that we started, over a year ago now, which is based off an American project called the Emergency Workplace Organizing Committee. And the idea behind the project is there are loads of people who don't have unions or aren't in a union or are new to organizing. And then there are people who have experience and, you know, have maybe been trade unionists for many years, like you and I or other people we know in the movement. But there's often not a connection between those two groups. And so what we've developed is essentially an online form that people who want to organize at work can fill out. And then we will introduce them to someone from the labor movement. We have a big kind of database of volunteers from across all different unions. So from both of our unions, but, you know, from the bigger unions like Unite and Unison, smaller unions like Bakers and Aslef and so on. And we'll introduce people to each other and then they get coaching on how to start organizing at work. And I really, you know, the way I think about it, this as a project is, you know, the organic links that a lot of people have to the trade union movement have fallen away. You know, a lot of people have never been in a union. They don't know anyone who's in a union. They can't do the kind of stuff that some of us were able to do of having family or friends who are trade unionists and getting on the phone and chatting to them when we had a problem at work and getting the kind of advice of, like, what does a union do? You know, what is collective organizing at work? And so we're trying to kind of rebuild some of those links through the project. And it's really interesting kind of hearing what people want or need when they're trying to get coaching on organizing at work. And to be honest, a lot of it is people just want someone basically to give them permission to do it. You know, they have the ideas, they know what to do, but they, you know, don't have someone to bounce ideas off. And so really it's just about generating those kind of links and supporting people to start organizing at work. So it's been an exciting project to be part of.
Yeah, and that's something I feel really strongly about actually. So it's good to hear, which is that you hear, good and bad, you know, worst case scenario, you get a finger wagging lecture, but quite often you get people saying, you know, you've got to organize, you have to organize, you know, and sometimes that's, you know, absolutely the right thing that needs to be said, but we don't talk enough about what that actually means. Now, as you say, I've been a trade unionist for some time now, and even I struggle sometimes. Like, we need to organize something here, but what do I mean by that? So it's not uncommon, you know, for that to happen. So I think it's great, really great to have an organisation that only crosses any of the barriers between, you know, sectors you work in or age or any of that kind of stuff. But actually, you know, more importantly, does it in a way that's that completely understands you know, the fact that you need to teach people practical skills about what it means to organize, especially in some of the workplaces we have now, which are traditionally not places where organization takes place, because they've resisted it, because the bigger unions have occasionally gone, well, we can't work out how to organize, you know, gig workers, because they're too kind of cut up and sporadic, you know, we can't do that, et cetera, et cetera. So Organize Now is a brilliant initiative, I think, actually, for that reason alone. So great work. What kind of stuff have you got coming up? Are there any particular sectors you want to you target organizing in at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I guess one thing I would say, yeah, responding a bit to you, is that I also think, like, organizing when there's not a union is such a different thing to organizing in a union. And so for me, a lot of the project is also about, like, getting people in the labor movement to talk to people who aren't and understand what the challenges are. You know, a lot of the so I do a bunch of coaching through the project, and the sort of things that I would do in my workplace, you know, these just aren't options for a lot of workers in more precarious, non-unionized workplaces, that, you know, if they do something, you know, challenge something at work, they're just going to get sacked, right? Yeah. Whereas my employer probably would like to sack me, but it's quite difficult for them to do that, right?
I think mine's got me on a hit list too, but never mind about that. Carry on.
Yeah. And so it's kind of like going back to the basics, right? Yeah, a lot of the conversations I have with people is about finding something collective they can do together. And I think that's an important reminder for us in the labor movement who, like, you know, have recognized unions, have, like, recognition agreements that give us certain things and so on, is, like, not to forget about doing stuff collectively with other people at work, finding out, like, how we do stuff together, because that's really, you know, that's where our power is. It's not in a collective, you know, in a recognition agreement that's been sitting in a drawer for 10 years, right? We're also seeing lots of places recognition agreements just being ignored by employers when they feel like they don't have to pay attention to them. But yeah, I mean, the kind of sectors where people are signing up are the sort of sectors you'd expect. So it's hospitality, care work, and a lot of education, actually. So, like, a lot of people working in schools and doing these sorts of things. But the two big industries that we don't have strong union representation in, hospitality and care. This is often low paid work, hostile employers, lots of young workers, lots of migrant workers. But there's a lot of energy, right? A lot of people signing up saying, I really want to do something. I want to figure out what it means to organize here. And that's one of the things that's really nice about the project, is, like, hearing the stories of where people have done something together. They've improved something at work. They've built a network. You know, these are the stories that kind of make me feel a lot more inspired than, I still don't know why I tuned in to listen to PMQs on BBC, but that's, like, the opposite kind of politics, right?
You could have been watching a Jean-Claude Van Damme film and scanning it for Marxist content and analysis. I always remember.
Exactly. That. Rather than, like, shaking my fist at, like, awful commentary from people in Parliament. No, you're right. I think, you know, Van Damme is always, I think, going to be higher up on the list than PMQs, right?
For sure. Now, I agree with you. It is incredibly inspiring. And, I mean, you know, when I first started getting into trade unionism, it was, it has definitely had its pluses, but it didn't have anywhere near the level of joy, the level of inspiration that I'm getting from now, which is, of course, young people, and not just young people, but there's a lot of that about, and people within sectors deciding to organize for themselves. And it's not like we've had some big, you know, teaching when, you know, someone like me with who's long in the tooth and bald of the head comes up and sort of says, well, you need to do it like this, and this is how we did it back in our day. I mean, we're available for that, right? But it's so great for me to kind of go to meetings that I often do, or go to strikes, picket lines, occupations, things like that, and just say, I'm here because I support you. Complete solidarity of what you're doing. And if you want to ask me anything, you can. But it looks to me like you've kind of got it together already. So actually, just as likely, I'm going to be asking you about how you organise this, that, or the other. You know, it's so inspiring. It's so, you know, that it is the very much the kind of darkest of times, and yet there are so, you know, many kind of beautiful, bright, shining cracks of light, you know, burning through. to see this sort of thing happening. It's an absolute wonder. I mean, when I came of age, it was globalization seemed to mean something different to what it does now. And we were looking across the Atlantic to things like students against sweatshops to see, you know, how wonderful that, and that was, I mean, that, and that definitely has something, it planted a seed in some of what we're seeing happen now in places, for sure. But it was never more than on a handful of campuses. And that's before we even get into, of course, you know, in all that period of time when Starbucks have been trying to unionize. And right now, across America, it's just, it's unbelievable. It's one store after another, after another, after another. And then there's Amazon. I mean, you know, what do we say? Magnificent. You know, they need a union with more balls than the GMB, in my opinion. But nevertheless, what's happening there is so inspirational, so wonderful. So just, you know, they got to keep it going. It's just wonderful. Yeah.
And I also think it means that, like, you know, people watch what happens at Starbucks who work in cafes and bars in London, right? Like people see that it's possible, see people like them who are doing it. And, you know, I never thought when I was younger, sitting in union meetings where these were not the most exciting places, that organizing unions would be like, you know, fashionable or like an exciting thing to do. And it does feel like that energy is coming back, right? Like people want to do this. They want to be part of it.
Yeah. I mean, I find that interesting because some people talk about it now as like, a fashion thing. Oh, it's a fad or it's virtue signal or whatever. And I just go, I don't give a shit. As long as they join the union, as long as they start their own union, as long as they get collective bargaining rights, as long as they get good employment terms, conditions and contracts. If you think they've just come for the sake of it being a fashion thing, I guarantee you that's the thing they'll stay for and they will stay.
Yeah. But also like it should be fashionable, right?
Yeah.
Like it should be exciting and it should be fun and it should be, you know, it gets revived by like new people getting involved into it, right? And it just feels like a bit of a sign of the times, right?
Yeah, some things never go out of fashion. And trade unionism is number one, I think, on that one. It's kind of like, it's never not needed. It's pretty not uncommon for me to meet sort of more right-leaning people who still think unions are a good thing, you know. I mean, never mind what they voted for back in the day, but nevertheless, they'll still go, yeah, I mean, you know, you bloody hell, your workforce needs to get together and organize and so they get the best benefits. It's a pretty, that's a pretty mainstream viewpoint, I think, in a lot of ways. And I don't mean in a bad way, you know, because most of the things mainstream are dog shit, but you know, this is actually something that's very much a plus.
Going to work to figure out that you need one, right?
Yeah, exactly. From the minute you get into work, you're like, blimey, this is shit. Not to mention in unions for the unemployed, but that's another conversation. I might do a history show one time, actually, about the sort of 2000s up to now, you know, and to talk about the way things have grown around the sort of anti-globalization movement and up to now. So speaking of a bit of good old-fashioned internationalism, you were just telling me Labour Notes. What's happening? You go into, that's the US event, isn't it?
So Labour Notes they do a conference every 2 years in the US in Chicago at a unionized hotel, of course, because, you know, it would be no good having a union event somewhere.
The only kind of hotel we stay in, yeah.
Yes, indeed. But it's a kind of, like a long-running, it's been a publication, they do training, basically about rank-and-file trade unionism, and bringing together people from across the labor movement to talk about successes, you know, examples, share stories about what works, what doesn't. And is, I think this year going to be 5,000 trade unionists from across the US. So I'm sure there'll be people talking about Starbucks, about the big strikes they've been having in higher education in the US, what's happening inside some of the bigger unions like UAW preparing for strikes. And so we're going to go along, a couple of us from Britain who've been involved in some of the public sector strikes, to talk a bit about what's been happening here, but also, yeah, get involved in some good internationalism, as you say, right?
It always works out well. I went to a Labour Start one in Berlin back in 2014, actually. So I haven't been to one since then. That was pretty good. It was interesting. Obviously, it was from the world over. And it was really interesting to meet folks, you know, with, well, different parts of the world, but same problems, really.
And it's good to kind of exchange notes and hear about what other people are doing and build those connections, right?
Yeah. We had a few. I remember actually a geezer I met there from, I want to say Finland. I could be wrong. It's one of those countries. I ran into him in London, actually, in the V&A Museum too, which were at the, what was it called? The Descent, that was it, the Descent Now exhibition, which I went to about three or four times, which everyone who knows maybe remembers that at the V&A. It was really cool. It's basically like all of these items from various different protests from, God, probably the, you know, the better part of the last sort of 50, 60 years, who had, I think he had a kind of show similar to what I've got now, but this was 10 years ago, so he was ahead of the game, doing sort of the, you know, his was specifically trade unionism, of course. This is whatever we fancy. Yeah, it's a small world for all of us.
Very happy to come on and have a chat about it afterwards, share some of the stories. Would be a nice thing to do.
Yeah, great. That would be terrific. And look, also, I might as well say this now. I've said this to a couple of people. If you got a recording device and you think, oh, I'm going to interview this trade unionist and have a little chat, more than welcome to, mate. Punt it over to me. I'll put it on the show. More than happy to.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Yeah, yeah. If you're chatting with someone, you just think, oh, this is great. You know, I don't want to use the word content. Pretend I didn't just use it. But if you think this is great content, then more than happy to cover it up on here. And I love doing that stuff. And frankly, if you can get me someone from the Starbucks Union, I will be Starbucks Workers United, to give them their official name, and Amazon Workers United, I will be very, very happy and in your eternal debt for being able to get hold of that for me.
Well, I will see what guerrilla podcasting I can do while I'm there.
It's the only way forward. So what else is happening, basically? Has anything else just sort of, I don't know, caught your eye recently? Or, you know, in a slight nod to something else we do together? Seen any good films lately?
I mean, obviously, because I think everyone in the world who has an interest in science fiction films, the Dune film, of course, which I think I saw recently, has just broken half a billion dollars in ticket revenue already. So I don't think I'm the only person who went to see it.
Yeah, I enjoy it. I like the first one more, if I'm honest, but I really did enjoy it. It's a wonderful piece of work. And I think they underline the drama so well, you know, with a character like Paul Atreides, you've got a really interesting state of affairs where you really do have someone who is being pulled in sort of different directions, you know, from the people around him, the influences around him. I thought the second one did a really interesting thing with his mother, Rebecca Ferguson's character, in which kind of like subtle. Well, okay, maybe I'm wrong about this. I know it's following what the storyline that's already been laid out in the books, but it seemed to me like she took on a position of a sort of, you know, suffering from a bit of PTSD and that having an effect on her behavior. I don't know if I'm wrong about it. That's just the sense I got from it. I mean, as a proper fan of the genre, what do you make of it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I think there's a bunch of, not to sound too nerdy, but there's a bunch of changes from the book. And I think, yeah, I think you're right in how that comes across. I mean, you know, there's also a lot less of the film of them in hiding, the kind of longer process they have of being out in the desert. Like a lot of that stuff happens a lot quicker in the film, right? Yeah, in part because the long monologues of Frank Herbert's writing probably don't transfer that well over onto film. And it's interesting. I thought the shift in tone from the first to the second film was quite stark. Like a lot more is happening. It happens a lot quicker. I kind of wondered how far through the story they would get with the film. But actually you get quite a lot, right?
And I think that, so as I haven't read the books, I've got to be honest. I did see the David Lynch version many, many years ago, which I've not rewatched. And on the shelf behind me, I actually have the TV series, which someone ripped for me, but I haven't even got around to watching that yet because I've been busy with trade unionism, funnily enough. But I thought that the overt anti-imperialism is the really most interesting thing that runs through it. Even though, because my understanding is that's not actually entirely with the position the books take, because they are, of course, still the outside force that come into this to rule this planet, but they're sort of the Atreides are supposed to be the slightly nicer versions of colonialists, which I wasn't mad keen on, but I was like, all right. Maybe we'll see what they do with the third one, this one, but I was a little reticent about seeing that, but it's a good film. I enjoyed it, basically. I really did enjoy it at just a basic level, and I can't say that about most films, especially large budget ones. They tend to just not be for me. One thing I did like, actually, coming back to, so what you say about Frank Herbert's kind of longer passages, I wonder if in the case of what the film does, both films do, I noticed with Denis Villeneuve that you get a lot more kind of interesting visual flourishes and the kind of, you know, imagination he has of his sister, his baby sister, and what she'll be like when she grows up. And it, throughout the first film and the second one, there's a lot of, the Paul character seems to have a lot of visions. And I found that really interesting because it creates what I think are quite, not exactly trippy visuals if you're a film fan. You know, if you're a B-movie fan, you've seen stuff far heavier than this. But for a mainstream film, it does seem kind of like a little bit out there for what you'd expect from, you know, a bunch of kids weaned on the Avengers, if you know what I mean. If that's part of the audience we're going for.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it is a, you know, as you say, there are some issues with the anti-imperialism in the film, but it is a much more... Yeah, it's kind of interesting to see Hollywood take such a gamble on spending so much money producing Dune, because it's, you know, it's really a story about the dangers of, well, the dangers of Paul, right? Of messianic political figures and a kind of, you know, critique of natural resource exploitation, of a range of things. You know, there are these political themes running through it that are quite different to a lot of other blockbuster films, right?
Yeah, but I mean, and what I like about it is that to some degree so far, at least in the first two films, it's kind of portrayed it as actually being, I mean, yeah, it is very political, but it also kind of is kind of inevitable. There's almost a part of sort of saying, look, if you're going to exploit resources, this is what's going to happen. And we can agree or disagree to a greater extent, whatever people want to, on whether or not that is the case. But I do think that the film, it's a very interesting position for the film to take from a dramatic perspective. Which is just like, yeah, you know, basically, if you're going to mess with resources, this is what's going to happen.
Agreed. I think there might be a longer deep dive on this, right, John?
But it's funny you should say that, because Jamie and I do a podcast, which I might have mentioned once already, called Marks at Play. And we are in negotiations for some more episodes, which I've got coming up. I don't want to say anything yet, actually. I want to record them so nobody nicks the ideas between now and then, you know, so let's get them. Not that as a paid up, you know, leftist trade unionist like me would have such a negative view of humanity that people would come along and steal my ideas. All I would say on that front is I'm not someone who has a hell of a lot of ideas in life, so please don't steal the few that I have. Yeah, we could do a Dune dive, I suppose. Yeah, why not? I rewatched the first one before we came on to the second one anyway, so I'm pretty up to date on it. As I say, you'd have to provide that I have not read the book, so you'd be able to provide the more specifics on that one. But other than that, so why not? Bringing us back to the main focus, though, I just want to ask you maybe a couple more things. Maybe we can go out with this, but maybe talk a little bit more coming back to higher education. You interact with your students, but what is their take on what's happening? Are you finding like a good level of support from that? Are they getting a good understanding of why you are doing what you do, and also not just the necessity for it for your, you know, way of life, but also for their benefit too? Do you think they get that better than most, or is there just lots of, you know, snooty letters saying, why am I not getting the education I paid for? Which by also actually isn't your fault. That's the university's fault, but you know, there you go. They do have a point there. But yeah, sorry, what's the response you're getting from students?
So I think that's an interesting question. Where I work, there's been a kind of rebirth of student activism, student organizing, particularly around Palestine. So there's a lot happening on our campus around organizing against BAE systems. You know, a lot of students who, like the rest of us, have just been watching, you know, what's happening in Gaza, the unfolding genocide, and wanting to do something about it. And what's been a bit different to kind of previous moments, you know, student movements around Palestine have, you know, there's like a long history of these, but, you know, they quite quickly have reached out to the union. They want to work with staff on thinking through like what organizing at work means for Palestine solidarity. So there's already connections with students being built. But I do think universities are different to when I was a student. You know, a lot of my students work. They just come in to study. They just come in for the lecture. They go and work other jobs the rest of the time. There's much less of that kind of student community than there used to be, I think. and that kind of breaks down the ability for some of that organizing to come into being. But I think it's not like they see the struggle of workers in universities as just like protecting the conditions of staff there. I think a lot of them know how low paid a lot of the sessional teachers are, or hourly paid staff who are doing their classes. I think people see it, you know, see that that's affecting their education system, you know?
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's obviously a very good thing. It's potentially, again, gives us a great bridge to build between those two worlds, because where traditionally, you know, academia and the world of work have often been separated, except when you're in the pub, you know, it's actually good to see a greater level of benefit coming from that. And lots of organizing opportunities, folks. That's what we're after. But also, yeah, I mean, I think Palestine, never a week should pass, I suppose, that we don't talk about it. But it's very interesting to me to see something. So like you might, like yourself, I've, you know, been in and out of that campaign for years. And well, mostly in it. And I've never seen it take on the level of importance it's taken. Now, obviously, because of the horrendous things that are happening on the ground. But also, it seems like it's a thing that's caught, you know, global attention to organize against ultimately changing the system all over. Because it's interesting to me too to see how quickly and terribly the excuses, I can't think of a better word for it, the excuses for support for this ethno-fascist apartheid state, which has never been able to stand on its own, despite all the things that it promotes itself as. The excuses for, you know, supporting that are just crumbling almost by the day. I remember going to an event called The Tipping Point many years ago, which is a PSC event they organized in London. And they talked about whether or not they thought that, you know, finally the occupation has got to that point where it was going to, we knew it wasn't sustainable, but it couldn't be sustainable even for those who supported it. And it is so very tragic and obscene that it has taken something as brutal and vile as this to see that happen. But it does seem to me like it's happening. I don't see Israel having a way back from this.
Yeah, I guess I'm still kind of taken aback at how widespread and how deep the solidarity movement is, right? You know, I think there's, you know, the scale of the demonstrations, the number of people who are turning out to them, the flags across East London, the organising that's happening in different places around this. I think, you know, it really is quite, you know, again, another, I can't remember how you put it earlier, but like another glint of hope and light breaking through, right?
Yeah. It's such a strange thing to comment upon, because it seems indecent to see anything good right now. But at the same time, it is happening. We're making it happen. And this is what solidarity looks like. And I think that, you know, sometimes looking at it, as you and I have actually discussed off air before, the kind of overwhelming darkness of seeing this. But, you know, wallowing in that darkness sitting in England does not actually benefit anybody Palestinian. So see the light for what it is, and let's amplify it, and let's... I'm being a little bit abstract here, so let me be more specific in my language. Keep campaigning, keep fighting, keep pushing back, keep supporting the Palestinians. And, you know, for all of the whataboutists, you know, well, you know, what about Palestine's occupied? What about the Western Sahara? What about the Tibet? Okay, well, let's get Palestine sorted, and we'll move on to those campaigns next. You don't honestly think people like us are going to stop campaigning on things like this, do you? It's simple as that. And by the way, you set up a campaign for those things, and I'll come to it. Something else I learned back in my days in the 2000s. Yeah. That's the way you deal with this. You don't walk up to other people and go, why are you not organising this? Because they'll quite rightly look back and go, why aren't you doing it?
Yeah, it's a risky thing to ask people to do, isn't it?
And it's just, especially when you're dealing with seasoned pros. So I think we've covered a lot of ground there, as ever, and we can always cover more ground in the future, because what we do best. Oh, one other thing I meant to ask you. You got any writing projects you're working on at the moment, or have you just been too busy? Because I was re-flicking through Marks at the Arcade again the other day, and, you know, I'm not sucking up to you. I've told you this before. I think it's a fantastic book. I've pushed it on a few people and said, yeah, just, this analysis is, you know, check this out. Not least some of my gamer nephews, I'm trying to get them to understand it at a higher level.
Have I got any writing projects at the moment? That's a good question. I'm doing a collected set of essays on the Star Wars Andor series, which is quite fun and will be done soon. But no, I have other stuff kind of, yeah, bubbling away, but nothing to share quite yet.
Okay, and you're still working with Notes from Below, of course.
Yes, and we have a new issue coming out in April. It will be ready, so we're almost there with that one.
Excellent. Well, we will promote it via the social media pages of this radio show. And not in the not too distant future, hopefully, we should have some Marks at Play content coming up for you good folks. And I'll have some more working class cinema too, if you happen to be interested, but that's another issue. In the meantime, as ever, from all the rage, Jamie, thank you so much, mate. It's always good to talk to you. Always good to catch up. Always good to share in the wonderful results of solidarity as much as any negative things that are happening around us. We cannot be beaten and we will not be beaten. And it's always good to talk to you, mate.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.tracksfm.org.